Yeah, so I'm very happy that I got funding for this new research project. It's called Causation, Complexity, and Evidence in Medicine, and it is a 4-year project. And I was going to just say a bit about what we have been doing so far. That is the background for the project, and also what is the idea of what we're going to do. So it's very early stages, so I hope you bear with me that everything is not like fully developed. Okay. So this is actually a project where I think philosophy has something to contribute to medicine, and especially the powers ontology, I think, is going to open up a lot of issues in a new way. So it seems in medicine that there is some movement. There is some movement within the paradigm. So people have various concerns. And when I say people, they're sometimes philosophers, but much of it is medical researchers, medical practitioners. And when I say medicine, I mean like health sciences. So it includes like physiotherapy, nursing, and psychology. So it's a broad term. And these concerns, they are sometimes methodological concerns. So for instance, both philosophers and medical practitioners have had some concerns about the use of randomized controlled trials, for instance. Nancy Cartwright has also written on that. And one sees that there are some problems. So, for instance, one problem is that in RCTs you have to treat patients like they are statistical averages of certain groups. So individual propensities, they seem to be directly derived from statistical frequencies. So practitioners have some problems with this because when they're sat there with the patient, they're not supposed to look too much at the individual patient and study what's wrong with them. So for instance, if you're a physiotherapist, you might have someone in front of you and they might have some low back pain and you wonder what could the problem be. And you're supposed to use various statistical tools, both for diagnosis and for finding the right treatment. So there's not much room left for the practitioner to use their own experience. So one might before have used to talk to the patient, touch them a bit, feel a bit here, ask a bit, and then figure out what treatment is maybe the best. But now you're supposed to take the treatment that has proven to be statistically working for most people, and you pick the top one. If that doesn't work, you pick the next one. But it takes the responsibility and the power away from the practitioner, and that is the evidence-based idea. So one idea is that you can have as many patients as you want. So let's say you've been practicing for 40 years, so you have a lot of experience. But the idea of evidence-based medicine is that you will never have had as many patients as these studies. So if you have like 400,000 people tested, you're supposed to use that evidence and not the few patients that you have encountered during your professional work. So some people are worried about losing that responsibility. Of course, if we think of legal responsibility, it's much better. If you didn't make the choice yourself, you just tick the one that was on the top. But if you said, yeah, so this is evidence-based, the most efficient one, and then you say, but I don't think that's good for you, so I'm going to use another treatment. If that fails, I mean, you can be sued, but you cannot be sued if you just pick the best one. So I think so people don't like that so much. there are some worries about the external validity of these population studies. If you're testing an intervention, you cannot test it on risk groups, for instance, so children and old people and very sick people. You shouldn't include them. Plus, if you're testing an intervention, they shouldn't already use other medications. And most people who are ill, they have more than one problem, so more than one medication, which makes it difficult to single out the causal effect on that thing. So you have to test on relatively young, relatively healthy people. But then the results are applied universally. You know, so you give it to the old people and then the young people. So professionals who work with old people or children, they have these concerns, for instance. There are also certain things you cannot test with RCTs for ethical and practical reasons. So, for instance, there are some people on my project working on the health effects of pollution, and if you're doing randomized control trials on that, you have to gas like one group with pollution and then the other with steam. You know, you just can't do that stuff. So there are certain things, and so it seems to favor certain interventions, you know, that you can test with placebo, and people are not aware that they're getting placebo. If you're testing, for instance, the effect of cognitive therapy, you cannot pretend to give people cognitive therapy. You know, it's not everything that works exactly for that. Okay, so these methodological concerns, you don't have to look at the handout because I don't think it's there. So these methodological concerns, they have led to, it seems to me, a certain move towards a more qualitative approach. Some people want more qualitative studies. It's more, some people want more focus on mechanistic knowledge, understanding how things work. Some people want to bring in patient stories. There seem to be some ideas about which kind of methods one could use instead or in addition. So that is like one move that we see in medicine. Then there is some concern about the medical model, the biomedical model. And a lot of medical researchers, they have emphasized the limitations of just looking at the biomedical aspect when we're checking for health. And these discussions are usually about dualism and reductionism, holism, things like that. So one concern is medicalization. Is medicalization a common term here? Because when I look it up, I usually find just Scandinavian literature. So it seems like it's not a big international debate.
Did you know at all?
No.
No? Okay, so medicalization is the... is the idea that you can reduce, for instance, a social phenomena, like you're being shy, to a psychological phenomena, social anxiety, then it's your problem, it belongs to you. And any kind of psychological problem can be solved biochemically. So you can have a drug, then you feel better in social settings. You know, so that is one way to think of medicalization. So another example could be if you have a conflict at work and you get ill and then you get depression, for instance, and then you can get some drug for that. Again, it's treated like your personal problem, not like a social problem in your interaction with others. So to medicalize various aspects of human life is considered to be a problem for a lot of people. Another problem is this idea of specialization or fractionalization of medicine, because usually illness is considered to be something that belongs to a part of you as a human being. So it's like your bowel, your liver, your heart, you know, it's a part of you that has the illness. And if you have a psychosocial aspect to your illness, it's abstracted away from or treated separately. So yeah, if your pain doesn't go away, maybe you have to see a psychiatrist or a psychologist or something like that, but someone else treat that. I treat the liver, someone else treat your head. So it's that kind of idea that seems to be, well, it seems to be problematic for many people who wants to see the patient as a whole, you know. So one thing that one has tried to do, and I think that was already in the 70s, was to introduce an alternative, which is the biopsychosocial model. Okay, so it brings in all the aspects. So it, at least it acknowledges that health is dependent on social, psychological, and biological factors. So that is also one move. So then it's the, so this was like the method and the biomedical model. And then there are also some concerns that are more related to the practice. So one is the loss of autonomy for the practitioner. So that is one thing that they have worries about. Another is the statistical average treatment of the patient. So a lot of practitioners sit there with the patients and they're not happy about what they are told to do by international health policies. So one aspect that is often thought to be missing is the seeing the patient as a whole person and to try to tailor the treatment to the person. So there is, I don't know how old this tradition is, but I think it's called person-centered medicine, and it's used often as a criticism of evidence-based medicine, but a very soft one. It's like, well, maybe we can have evidence-based medicine and add some person-centered approach where we, like, we use all the evidence we have available, and then we try to tailor it to the patient, but we also want to look at their historical and social, cultural, family setting, you know. So they bring in the kind of ethical and normative aspect and the human aspect into medicine, which many people think is a bit lost. And so some of the people on my project, they work on that. And when we talk about it, they say that it's not new. It's what it used to be back like 3-4 generations ago, when you had the family doctor who knew your family history and they knew about your life and they would take all this into consideration, you know. So it's not treated as some new revolutionary thing, but the idea is to place the patient in a larger context and take that context into consideration when you treat them. Okay. Yeah. So it seems like we have these concerns, they are related, but they're usually discussed a bit separated. You know, so when philosophers talk about methods, they don't necessarily care so much about the person-centered medicine or the biopsychosocial model. When we introduce the biopsychosocial model, we don't necessarily look at the other aspects. So the idea of this project is to bring people with these variants concerns together, add philosophy, and see if we can find something that is more uniting. So the idea is to push us over to another paradigm. Yeah, so it seems a problem if you just change, for instance, the methods, but you keep the kind of reductionist or dualist approach, you know, or if you just add the person-centered perspective, but the methods are the same. So it seems like to make a proper change, you have to move all parts. You cannot just move like one part and keep everything else. So I'm interested in this from the perspective of causation and probability, but also ontology. because I think the ontological aspect has not been properly addressed, because I don't think there has been this dispositionalist approach to medicine. A lot of people say they are interested in causation, but they don't understand it. They need it, but they have all these ideas of what it's supposed to be. And that's what I'm going to talk about a bit more now. One thing that made me interested in looking at the medical field was that I met someone, Tor Eirik Eriksen, who told me about these medically unexplained conditions. They turned out to be many. So about 30% of all symptoms reported to general practitioners in Europe and other industrialized countries are classified, in a way, in a vague sense, as medically unexplained, which means that there has not been found a clear physical cause, or even just a common cause that is statistically significant. These conditions, which count as medically unexplained, that's a big controversy. But some of those conditions that are often described as unexplained in this sense is the irritable bowel syndrome. So anyone having problem with their stomach and they cannot find anything that could explain it, it's irritable bowel, you have IBS. And it sounds like something, you know, something you can go home with, nice diagnosis. Chronic fatigue syndrome, that's one. Low back pain, but the non-specific low back pain. it has over 80% life prevalence. It's one of the biggest problems we have for work disability, hospitalization. It's like a major problem. But then you also have things like anxiety, general anxiety disorder, tension type headache, that can diagnose all sorts of things, including if you're like paralyzed in your face and no one can understand why. It's a very broad class. Post-traumatic stress disorder, fibromyalgia. So those are some of these conditions, and they're becoming more more known, more common, it seems. What is strange about these conditions is that there are young people with these problems, relatively young, a lot of women. I think some numbers say like 66% of those are women having those problems. People sometimes get work disabled in their 30s or 20s because of these things, so it's not good for society. So it's a major cost. I think everyone wants to understand it, and they're trying to, but the problem is that they have to use the normal methods for finding this. And the problem with these conditions is that they have extreme individual variety. So they cannot find even symptoms in common from one patient to another. So there's usually a cluster of symptoms. And a lot of these are overlapping. So people with general anxiety disorder usually have problems, or often have problems with pain, kind of pain, and with the tension type headache, and so they are clusters, and the symptoms come in very various degrees as well. So it's hard to pin down exactly what is this illness. And when they look at the causal story, they find many causal stories on the individual level, but nothing can be backed up epidemiologically. so they cannot find enough to say that this is the cause. So, for instance, when you look at non-specific low back pain, they have tried to do x-rays and check out what's wrong with these backs, and they don't find anything in common. So first they thought, oh, this spine looks crazy, no wonder you're in pain. But then they saw top athletes with exactly the same spine, so it couldn't be that. So, and some people, they bent down to pick up something and then they got pain, and other people bend down all the time, they don't get pain. So it seems difficult. There's also not a very clear division between the psyche and the soma here. So a lot of people have some psychological symptoms, some somatic symptoms, and it's not clear how they interact. So these conditions are usually looked at as empirical problems or epistemological problems. So the idea is that we're waiting for an explanation. If we only have more data, if we perform more RCTs, so if we just do more of the same, then we will eventually find the cause. And a lot of people are waiting for that one physical little thing that's going to explain everything about chronic fatigue or irritable bowel. So there's a lot of stake here. But some people have interpreted the problem with these medically unexplained symptoms as a problem with current medical thinking. So they have interpreted them as limit cases of the paradigm. And this is what we're going to do in this project. We're going to look at these conditions as symptoms of some deeper ontological, some deeper conceptual problems. And one of these problems is how to detect causation when you have cases of complexity and variation, because that is not the typical approach that we're looking for. But it's the reality that very often you have complex diseases. So most, well, when I started doing this with the medically unexplained, people said to me, but it's nothing special about the medically unexplained. You have the same with cancer, with heart disease, with autism or Alzheimer. You have all these clusters of symptoms, and you have individual variations, but it seems to be to a smaller degree. But it made me think that this is more, it's more than just a problem with the medically unexplained. It is a problem of the complexity and variation in general. It's just that when it's more complex, more variation, it comes as a bigger problem. Because with the other conditions, at least we know something about the physical mechanisms involved, so it makes us think that we understand them much better. Okay, so these three problematic features of the medically unexplained symptoms that I will focus on is they are the complexity and the heterogeneity and medical uniqueness. And I will try to say something about how these challenge the current medical model. So first I will start with the variation, the heterogeneity. So for these conditions, it's the rule rather than the exception that you have very large individual variations. It's a problem for the methodology, because when we use population data to look for causes, we look for homogeneity. We look for the same, you know. So we want to see what is common. A common cause, common effect. So that's what we're singling out. So even if there are like variations within your group, the idea is that if you just took everyone who had the same symptoms and the same cause, so what was common, and everyone was like them, you would have 100% success, you know. So you can find individual variations within a group, but then you can also make a subgroup where you take the people who are the same and place them in one group, and then you only add people who are like them, you know. So the idea is that then you would get the same for everyone, so homogeneity. So it seems that patients report causal stories for their conditions. So for instance, work conflict, or like the bending down or falling, or maybe a long period with stress, something that triggered or seemed to trigger the condition. But as I said, there's not enough to back this up statistically. So it seems like it's not that there are no causes, it's just that we cannot say scientifically that there is a cause. And it's a problem, because for the patient as well, if you say that, well, yeah, that is not medically or statistically backed up, it seems like they're kind of making up problems. So one of the problems with these conditions is that people get the impression that it's all in your head, you know, so they're not taken seriously by the profession. And if people suggest that it might be like a psychological aspect to it, they don't like that either. Okay, so as I said, in evidence-based medicine, you have the premise that what is true for a population should be applied to the individual. So what works for most people should also work for the patient, if you have specified the right subgroup. Okay. So that's the kind of external validity from your studies to the patient that you have in front of you. It seems to only work if you go for a specific type of probability theory, frequentism, because then the kind of individual propensity is given by the statistical frequencies. So in medicine, you don't have only one method, you have many methods, and I have this on the handout. There is a hierarchy in medicine. There are some ideas that some methods are better for finding causation than others. And at the bottom is kind of expert opinion. It's the doctor who has like unsystematic clinical observations. So they have various patients, but that's not considered very much. Then you have some kind of mechanistic knowledge. It's also not considered to be very high evidence of causation. Then you have correlation data of observation studies, which is a bit higher. And then over there is randomized control trials, and then you have systematic reviews of correlation data and of randomized control trials, where you sit down and you look at all the studies that are done within this field for this factor. What have they found? And then you compare. So it's like a big correlation study of those randomized control trials. So it's like more data. So it's even stronger. But then on top, interestingly, we have the N of one trial, where it's just like one individual that you check. So that is on top, but it's not so often used. Okay, so the interesting idea with the pyramid is that it seemed like all of these different methods are pointing in the same direction, upwards towards causation. But I think if we look at the methods, that they fit different concepts, different philosophical concepts of causation. So, for instance, the observation studies, where you look for correlation data, they seem to fit kind of regularity view of causation. So you're looking for correlations, and yeah, I'm not going to say so much about that. And the randomized control trials, there you compare two different groups and you see if the intervention makes a difference. So it seems to point to some kind of difference making notion of causation. One of the concerns there has been that if you compare two groups and you treat them in one group and it works, it seems to work in that group independently of whether you have a control group. So ontologically, causation should be going on within that group and within that patient. But epistemically, you have to compare it to figure it out. A problem in some of the international health policies is that they collapse those two, and they say that causation is only causation is defined as performed RCTs and demonstrated difference making. So that's a very strong commitment to the difference making approach. And then all these population and large scale population studies, systematic reviews, seem to suggest that we figure out causation in the concrete by looking at the general covering law, a universal law. So causation happens, this intervention is going to work for you because it works for everyone else. So that is a universal theory. I'm not sure if it's called universal theory, it's just, I know the opposite is the singularist view, so I just call it the universal. I think maybe the covering law model of causation is maybe more used. So the opposite view is the singularist view, where causation happens in the concrete and maybe you can say something general about it. So if one patient has some allergic reaction to a medication, you might think that perhaps other people have the same. Maybe there's some kind of causally relevant thing going on here in that medication that we should check. So you try to extract something a bit more general without assuming that it applies universally. So, but still you would say there is something going on there in the concrete independently of what happens elsewhere. So this individual patient is interestingly at the bottom and the top of the evidence pyramid. So this kind of physiological mechanistic understanding seems to suggest there is something intrinsic going on. And then the NO1 studies, where you have only one patient, is also on top. So it doesn't seem to be a very consistent ontological grounding of the of this hierarchy. Of course, this hierarchy is massively discussed in medicine, so some people want to place them next to each other and say, you know, you should use a bit of everything, or and some people would want to only use observation studies and not go for the randomized controlled trials, for instance. So it's different discussions, but this is a very common way to organize them. So I think another commitment of the population studies is to frequentism. And I have met more objections to this from philosophers than from the medical field. So if I say that we cannot go from statistical frequencies to the individual patient, some people say this is a matter of life and death. It's very dangerous if we do it your way. If we're going to look at the individual situation, it seems like we're going back in time like 2,000 years, and that's not what we're supposed to do, and evidence-based is much better. But in the medical field, a lot of people say it's a very common discussion that they have, that you cannot just go from statistical frequencies to individual propensities, but that's what they're supposed to do. So sometimes it seems like people from other fields assume that they know what they're doing in medicine, so we shouldn't criticize it. But I see that they're pretty critical from the inside, a lot of them. Okay, so one thing I have been doing in my previous project, Causation in Science, is to look at how these the relationship between philosophical theories of causation and probability is reflected or chosen in scientific methods. So people might not have any idea about what causation is, but once they choose their methods, they have already accepted something. And here we have accepted all sorts of things, which I will come back to. Okay, so complexity In these medically unexplained symptoms, there are a lot of researchers working only on one of these, for instance. And they have a big discussion there is the limitation of this monocausal model, where we only look for one factor, one causal factor. And they say instead we have to go for this multifactorial causation. But the problem is that if you go for the biopsychosocial model and you're acknowledging that the patient is whole and they have all these different levels, you're still stuck with the methods. And the methods, they would force you to check one thing at a time. So you can perform one study to check the effect of stress on your health, or or maybe check the effect of depression on your physical health or something. So they can like test various parts, but then you have to add the results together, you know. So you cannot do an RCT where you put in like 50 factors. There would be no way of tracing it back. But in the patient, they come as an integrated whole. And when you have studied them, like, okay, so I have studied 200,000 people for this factor and 200,000 other people for this factor, and then I put them together and that's you. It doesn't seem to actually treat you as a unit, you know. So this is one criticism that has come against the biopsychosocial model. It seems to assume this kind of mereological composition, that the different parts don't interact. So you're still like these blocks and bricks. So it seems like we can want more complexity, but we don't get away from, for instance, dualism or mereology or this fractional approach to health. So one thing that often happens with these patients is that they get stuck in a specialism. So if you come to the general practitioner with like 5 problems and they're all related, they will still send you to check one of the things, you know. You cannot. So if it's like the headache or the bowel, or, and then once you're stuck in the system, it's not like it's so easy to get out. If they haven't found it yet, they're going to check, you know. So it's this way that the medical field is organized as well. You have all the heart specialists over there, and then the people with the bowels over there, the kidneys over there. It's already fractionalized, you know? So it seems that it's hard to use this method and accommodate this kind of holist perspective, and also nonlinear interaction of the various causal factors. Okay, and the last feature is medical uniqueness. So since the symptoms of these conditions are very complex and they're a bit vague and overlapping, it's very hard to classify. Very hard to classify these conditions. So they talk about medical uniqueness, that the patient seems to be diseased in their own way. It's that big variations between the patients. So they seem to have a unique set of symptoms and also a unique expression of the condition. So I think this is not so strange. So we know that patients will respond differently to a treatment. So you could have the same treatment if one has a mutation and they cannot, they will have a different reaction if you have like an allergy, maybe towards penicillin, it's not going to make you that much better. So it's, we do expect people to meet the treatment with different contexts. So it seems like when we give people a treatment, we are assuming falsely that if there is real causation, they should have the same effect. So the when we test for it, we test for something that is context independent. So one very important aspect of the randomized controlled trials is to have large variety so that you can see, is this really causation? It's not just women over 60 or men under 30. You try to have represent the whole population. Well, with the problems I mentioned earlier of the very, you cannot include children or very old and sick people. So it seems that you one has this idea that causation is something that is more like determining and pushing its effect into various contexts. And if it goes through in all these contexts, then it's real causation, you know. So, but I think it's a problem that we think that that should be the default. So I think these expectations have a human origin, and I'll talk about that now, the ontological commitments, because it seems like we have a number of human assumptions in the current medical model. One of them is causation, what causation is. I think whether we think of causation as robust correlations or difference making, same cause, same effect, probability raising, it seems to come from ideas that Hume has already discussed. And also in the Humean ontology, causation is a kind of relation between two discrete, totally unrelated otherwise, events. And causation is also something that is derived from the facts. So if we knew all the facts in the world, we would also know all the relations between them. So it's not like you start with understanding the relations and then whether or not these facts actually occur. It's not like hypothetical truth. It's like start with the data and then you derive the relations. So this is backing up the Mereological idea, I think, that we can see in the medical model. If we have this idea that the data are spitting out the causal truth, then it seems like the more data we have gathered, the more causal truths we will find. And when we want to really know whether something is causing something else, we should ideally know all the past, present, and future data for those, which is why we go for so large-scale studies. The more people you have in your studies, the closer we get to the causal truth. You know, because then you have a better reason, one thinks, to infer from this group to the next group that you study. I don't think that automatically follows. It is a very radical form of empiricism. So a lot of epidemiologists, they don't want to talk about causation. They don't want to say something that goes beyond the data. So the data themselves should be enough. So they would say things like, we have found this correlation, we have found these probabilistic or statistical correlations, but they don't want to say that this actually causes that. So to understand how something works, an intervention works, or why it works, is then considered too problematic and too much extra facts that we don't have. So instead we look at the data and figure out that it works. So when you have the RCTs, the two groups, and you can see that there is an increased effect in the treatment group, then you can see, well, it works. But when you say it works, it suggests already that it's something working in the concrete. It sounds like causation to me, but it's not supposed to be that. Still, they do distinguish between accidental correlations and the correlations that they're interested in to find out that it works. Of course, that's a problem, because if you just look at the correlation data, there are lots of weird correlations that are almost perfect, like the margarine consumption in the US is almost 100% correlated with the divorce rate in Maine. So if you just look at correlation, that should be a very good, it works, very good example of things working. But I mean, the oral contraception pill giving thrombosis, 1,000 women, sounds like a far weaker correlation, but we think it's causal, you know. And if you smoke twice as much, 2 in 1,000. So the way that we pick out which correlations that interest us medically and those that don't, if we don't want to talk about causation, it seems like we're a bit lost there. But I still think this kind of radical empiricism comes from the idea that the data themselves are sufficient. We don't need the mechanisms. Or when I say mechanism, I just mean how it works and the way it works, even if it's social or psychological. When I talk to medical people, they think of mechanism as physical. So that's usually a sign of reductionism. I don't mean it like that. Okay, so an alternative to this, which you all know, is the framework of dispositionalism. And I would, of course, including an understanding of causation and probability. Because the dispositional ontology acknowledges context sensitivity, complexity, I think anti-reductionism and holism, tendencies, and singularism. And I think it's perfect in that sense for understanding the medically unexplained symptoms, because these are exactly the features of these conditions. And these features, the context sensitivity and holism and things, it's a problem for the Hume model. Should I talk about the dispositional theory?
We are basically all very much fans, but the point is that it depends how much time you'd like to have for discussion.
Yeah, so I don't have to talk a lot about that.
Yeah.
It's just that...
But we are excited about it, so that's fact.
Okay, yeah, so I don't need to go much into detail about it.
Just give us the exciting highlights.
Exciting highlights, okay. So, for dispositionalists, since we acknowledge things like threshold effects, extreme context sensitivity, mutual manifestation partners that are more than just two, and also this kind of non-linear interaction, we would take it as a default that the patients would have individual responses and individual sets of causes. So the importance of tailoring a treatment to the patient by looking at the total situation kind of comes out of that understanding of powers and how they interact. So in the theory of me and Stephen Mumford, we think that there is no clear distinction between the background conditions and the cause. So it's not like you can pick out a stimulus and then pick out the effect. It's a genuine complex situation. So if we look at a treatment and the patient's body and their context is already bringing in most of the causal work. Most of the mutual manifestation partners come from the patients themselves, you know. So when they get the intervention and it starts interacting, it's obvious that that's going to be very different from everyone else, which, because they would have different medical, biological, social, psychological factors that they bring to the situation. So I have this on the handout, the one of the figures there, which just shows with the vector model how you can have the same type of intervention in two different contexts and get the threshold effect in one and not in the other because of what else is there. So, and here I have assumed just linear composition, but once we bring in non-linearity, it's even worse. But so it just shows the context sensitivity. And the question is then why do we expect the treatment to have the same effect? And that's the same with the cause. So if we think that someone got low back pain from bending down, we shouldn't expect that everyone else bending down get chronic low back pain, you know, because why should they? Someone might be in a threshold effect or tipping point already, or there might be lots of other things pointing in the same direction or some weakness already. So it wouldn't be strange that you cannot find the statistical data to back up that everyone in the same situation would get it. So it just seems like a non-starter to think like that in medicine. So I think dispositionalism is really good for explaining why you have medical uniqueness and context sensitivity, the variety and the complexity that we see in the medically unexplained symptoms. So if we look for these epidemiological invariances when we look for the cause of medically unexplained symptoms, it seems like we will never find that. So also we should not expect that the individual propensities of two patients are the same, because the propensity of someone getting cancer rather than others, it will be very different depending on their diet and lifestyle and their genetics. So we cannot just say that because such and such a large percentage of the population get it, that you have such and such percentage of getting it. You know,
that.
So one in 1,000 chance of getting thrombosis wouldn't be correct for everyone. So I think these medically unexplained symptoms, they are very good at showing what are the problems or the limits of the current model. I think so. And I think if we bring in the ontology, I think we can also see what is common for these worries about the methods, the quantitative methods. Because if you go for singularism, the quantitative methods, they will be, if they work on their best, at their best, they will be representative. But that doesn't mean that we can apply it the other way, that you can go from the statistics to the individual. And also the person-centered medicine, I think they would also find the dispositions ontology useful if they want to look at the context of the patient and how that is relevant for the health and disease. And I think also the problem with the biopsychosocial model, if we are genuine holists, it gives them the anti-mariological ontology that they need. So I think it could be a really interesting project to bring these people together and have them discuss the various parts and then bring in the philosophical perspective, because I think there is a need for the ontological discussion in the medical field. I think they want it, and they seem very excited about talking to each other about these things as well. So I think this kind of inter or cross-disciplinary research is about time. I think there is a lot of it going on already, but as I said, a lot of it is focusing on certain parts, certain aspects. And it will be interesting to see how it goes.